Everybody, welcome to episode 125 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back. Welcome aboard. I am coming to you from a rooftop in southern Spain. I am currently in Canillas de Aceituno, a small village in the province of Malaga, in the region of Andalusia. And so if the audio sounds a bit different, that is why. This is the first episode being recorded from a rooftop in a small Spanish village. Yes, Erica and I are 10 days into our move across the globe, so wish us luck on acquiring our residency visas. We have so far finally gotten acclimated to the time change, to the intense heat that is still going on right now. And we were welcomed to Canillas de Aceituno by a 5-day festival that would go on until the wee hours of the morning or until sunrise each day. On top of the jet lag, it definitely took a while to get used to the time change when there was live music and DJs until 6 or 7 a.m. every day. But do not let it be said that Spaniards do not know how to party and have a good time, because clearly they certainly do. We are also rapidly approaching the end of season 6. After this episode, there are at least 2 more episodes to go. I will at least take us through the month of September, and I'm hoping to release 1 special episode at the beginning of October, but we will see if that happens. On today's episode, we have the return of Jeanette Stosky. Longtime listeners may remember her from episode 17, recorded 9 years ago, as we point out repeatedly in this discussion. She has recently released a book called The Outdoor Leader. We talk a lot about that, about why she wrote that book, what that process was like. But we also talk about AOR, the Association for Outdoor Recreation and Education, and their newest initiatives. And we cover a variety of other things, including a really interesting sounding road trip that her family took from Michigan to Alaska. Of course, Jeanette's open water swimming, and a lot of other things. So let us all travel back a few months ago, where we recorded this across the internet from Michigan to California. And now it is coming to you from southern Spain. So with that, let's go talk to Jeanette Stosky.
Hello, my name is Jeanette Stosky, and I am calling in today from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And in this space, I am the Executive Director of the Association of Outdoor Recreation and Education. And most recently, I just wrote a book called The Outdoor Leader.
All right. And so you mentioned AOR, the Association for Outdoor Recreation and Education. I think one of the quick things we can do is just explain to people what that is, because I imagine most people listening are not familiar with it, and maybe they should be.
You're exactly right. So AOR is how we call it. The Association for Outdoor Recreation and Education is a nonprofit, a 501c3, celebrating its 31st year. And really, the mission of the association is to help those who are helping facilitate outdoor recreation education. So really, the people who are introducing the outdoors, they could work at a college or university, a military base, a nonprofit, but think of them as the people who are taking people out, teaching them how to hike or camp or fly fish or recreate in any sort of way. Some people might use the word guide, but a lot of my members are educators. So what AOR does is brings information to those people so they can be better at their jobs. So helping them understand industry trends or issues, or how to be a better communicator, or how to update your program to be more inclusive. Those are the things that the association takes its time to center on to help, again, people who facilitate outdoor recreation be better at their job.
And as you and I were talking about before we started recording, it's been 9 years. You have been on this show before. It was 9 years ago. It amazes me that I've been recording these for nearly that long. Yeah, and we met at the Outdoor Retailer Show in Utah, and we stood behind some pavilion. I did re-listen to that episode, and I remember there being some sort of air conditioning unit. And it is not nearly as prevalent in there as I thought it might be. So good on us. But anyway, that is quite a tangent. But yes, so it's been 9 years. So a number of things have probably changed in your life. But also you've been with AOR for those 9 years as well, right?
That's correct.
And when I spoke to you before, how long had you been? Well, I'm not going to make you do the math. How long at this point have you been with AOR? How long have you worked with AOR?
Yeah, you're so great. This will be the 14th year. So yeah, so I was 5 years in, I think, when we spoke last. So I have been with the association for a fair spell of time. But the reason, you know, that I've had, I think, such a long tenure is that the work is ever changing, right? The issues that members face change, right? We've just gone through a pandemic, or maybe new equipment is coming out, or we're becoming more aware of the challenges that people have in getting permits to go into public land. So there's always an issue. And so we work to try to find those solutions. And again, it's great to be in a work environment where you never know what you're going to get in the course of a day. You might be trying to raise money, you might be trying to recruit and think about what your members' needs are. You might be trying to manage your staff. You might be trying to, you know, consider an issue or an article and reflect upon it. So it's brilliant work to be doing because I'm so passionate about getting people outdoors. So I like it.
Yeah, it's funny. You touched on a little bit exactly what I was preparing to ask you about, which is over 14 years, you're going to see a lot of changes in an organization. And also the outdoor industry in general and society in general has changed a fair amount over those 14 years. Are there any things you want to highlight? Any things that you've seen change over that time period, or things that maybe 14 years ago were not important or did not appear to be important to the outdoor community that are now very important parts of your job and also the community in general?
You know, I think a lot of the things that have come to light actually were unveiled during the pandemic, right? So the pandemic really was a time that allowed the outdoor industry both to find failure and to find its footing. So when I say find failure, we started to recognize how exclusive outdoor recreation has been. And it's always been exclusive to many people have not felt included outdoors. And so I think through the pandemic, when everyone had an opportunity or better opportunity to recreate locally or get outdoors, people realized that power of being outside, the transformative, you know, sitting in the outdoors. I know that you are passionate about getting people outdoors and getting outside, but thinking about that that's accessible, just going out your door. It doesn't have to be the highest mountains or the far off rivers or, you know, flying a plane somewhere. That just getting outside is great. But we also recognize at our association how we can help, again, someone who's has power and privilege in a leadership role, think about how they're introducing the outdoors, you know, how they're recruiting their staff, how they're making their programs accessible, how we are doing that in a more intentional way. And again, I think the pandemic has given us a lot of pause on that and has made people, and is one of the big issues. So really it's been a longstanding issue that was unveiled through that. I think a second thing, Jason, when I think about the transition of the last 14 years is this outdoor economy. And again, everyone says the outdoor economy, but what is that? And how do the dollars make the work that I try to do more effective and more impactful? So, you know, you're seeing state offices that are coming together and really leveraging, you know, I mentioned Michigan because I'm one really proud of it, but with our Great Lakes and getting people outdoors, how do you get more people outdoor in Michigan? How does that bring jobs, manufacturing or guiding or education? That's a big conversation that's happening that wasn't maybe happening before through our tenure. So I think outdoor economy, green pathways, outdoor access, inclusiveness. And then, of course, you have things like the equipment. The equipment has come and gone. It's gotten better and faster. It's gotten lighter. It's gotten more expensive. It's been all of those things. So I just always laugh when I say that last part, and so did you, is that for such a simple thing, going outdoors, we like to make it really complicated. And I don't know if it's our egos or the next best thing, the next lighter bike, the next more packable stand-up paddleboard, but we like to complicate it. That's not lost on me of irony of that, of getting people outdoors.
Especially the world of camping. I think the world of camping might be the most unnecessarily complicated part of the outdoor industry. It does seem a little bit like the shift has become camping means you are in some sort of large vehicle, and sleeping on the ground or in a tent is becoming less and less common, which is the cheapest, easiest way to get anyone outside. So I would love to encourage people to continue to sleep in relatively inexpensive tents when compared to the price of a van or an RV or something like that. So in the last few years, in those last 9 years since you and I have talked, are there any really interesting initiatives that have come and gone or any big wins for AOR that you want to highlight? Any things that pop to mind that have occurred within that time period that you're really proud of?
I think the thing I'm most proud about my association is continued maturation, just really thinking about how we're doing the work and who we're serving. And again, I use the word inclusive and exclusive a lot, but I think the board and I realized that we had been exclusive by really only focusing on higher education, military garrisons, other nonprofit people. We realized that we were already kind of catering to a group that already had privilege and maybe access and awareness of the outdoors. And so we've really tried to be much more intentional about thinking about, okay, we are definitely an association of people who are in those roles. How can we make those decision makers better? And again, I keep on going towards that direction because it's really been a journey, and it will be an ongoing one of recognizing that it's much more than just discounting trips or making gear more accessible. We have other work to do on the places and people that are going out, and we're working really hard. And I also would say, Jason, we're making a lot of mistakes, but I think that's okay if we're making mistakes on the path of learning, because as we know better, we can do better in this work. So again, just thinking about how we have excluded people and programming in our efforts and how we can change that narrative. I mentioned that I keep on using those words, but I want to just come back to that place-based programming. You know, again, I like to go far off places to recreate and get on the plane and see the big mountains that we don't have here. But I think there's been a level set of that is not being inclusive. That is not maybe how everyone will have a chance to recreate. And so what can we do to make those urban adventures, those out your back door, getting more people out in that way is just as powerful for people. It doesn't have to be a 21-day in the mountains excursion.
No, it's a great point. And recently, someone who's appeared on the show before, who hosts his own outdoor podcast, he and I have kind of joined forces and started this sort of side project called Hometown Explorers. And exactly what that is we talk to different people and ask them to choose and describe three locations near them, one that's 3 minutes away from their home, one that's 30 minutes, and one that's 3 hours. And then share photos and various other things and why those three places are interesting to them, because he and I are convinced no matter where you are, there are great outdoor, opportunities. Even if the 3 minutes away is your own backyard, your own backyard might be an interesting place to go outside. So yeah, I think that's a great point in general, is that we don't have to go to another country. We don't have to go somewhere for a month. We can go somewhere near home, or we can go somewhere for a weekend and still have a really worthwhile experience.
100%. And I think about that, in those 9 years, I do have two kids, and they've grown and they've aged. And I just even think about how they are connected to the outdoors in different spaces, right? Like how we, walking to, school or sports, or just finding those local parks and places. I don't necessarily think I would have done that, 9 years prior. I probably was chasing the next big trip, or, let's get to another national park, which aren't bad things. I'm not passing judgment on that, but I think there's a maturation that has happened to all of us that we can think about that. And just meet for a walk and talk, or sitting outside for lunch. I mean, there are other ways that we can include outdoor spaces in our lives, and just making that choice to do it, right? That's the hard part, is just making that choice.
Yeah. And I think what's really important about that is once you do that, it's the difference between something being a vacation, a once a year sort of activity, and then you can shift it into a lifestyle, where your lifestyle is incorporating the outdoors in your life, as opposed to periodically I take a vacation and go do a weird outdoors thing that is unusual in my life for a week or two or whatever. So yeah, I think integrating that into our lifestyle is super valuable. I think socially, the impact is very positive once we kind of accept nature and outdoors as part of our life and something valuable other than for solely resource extraction.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. And it sounds like you and your colleague, even in your intentionality, right? 3 minutes or 30 minutes, right? That's an everyday thing. That's a weeknight thing versus, Memorial Day weekend or just a one-off, right? So then you can get that transference every day. You can kind of dip into that just by checking the weather. And, again, I think you probably would agree there's no bad weather. So in and out, but you might decide how long
clothing,
you want to be out.
Only bad clothing. That's the saying, no bad weather. And where you live, that is especially true up in Michigan.
Exactly. But there's so much wonder. I mean, again, as we're recording this is right after the great, you know, aurora showings that are happening all across. And just, I mean, think about how many people just went outside in the last 3 or 4 nights to see the Northern Lights. I mean, what magic. And those things are all around us, right? Birds or storms or anything. It's there. We just have to pause and see it.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I mean, you're in Michigan. You're pretty far north. So did you get a good show?
You know, it was wonderful. Now, I will admit, I was actually already in bed. I'm more of a early to bed and early to rise.
Right.
But the pictures were amazing. And I know lots of friends and people just captured some great shots. I did have a chance to see the Northern Lights within this year. So I feel like I've had my taste. But again, I would have loved to have seen those bright reds and all that activity.
It's easy for those sorts of things to like get blown out of proportion or for people to get sick of hearing about them. But there is a real magic to when something like the eclipses or these storms that are causing these auroras in places that typically don't have them. There is something really special about that. And it is really nice to see so many people interested in that and that we can still be wowed by just what's outside our home that, you know, doesn't involve necessarily us learning to do an activity or something, but just appreciating what exists around us and kind of the majesty of nature.
You're so right. Again, we talked about that with camping, right? You know, that, mm-hmm. that connection of making it simple, but there is just so much wonder and awe. The total eclipse, right, about a month ago, and being able to see that. We were actually just off the path of totality, so got to go down and experience that and the aurora. But again, it's just like the other night, storms coming through, right? When you hear the rain start to fall and it kind of picks up. I mean, it's there if we just can have the discipline or prioritize getting outdoors and feeling that magic and making it accessible to anyone in any space, right? And creating
right.
that love for it. Yeah. So that's you know, obviously for someone who's dedicated my whole career to it, incredibly passionate about it, but I also love passing it along to friends and family. And it could be in any form, a backyard bonfire, a walk, you know, sitting on a dock and figuring out life as we are outdoors.
So as we have pointed out, or I have pointed out multiple times during this, 9 years ago, we spoke together. You were, if I remember correctly, episode 17, over 100 episodes ago, and 9 years have passed. And we discussed a lot in that episode, so I don't want us to just rehash all of that. But what I do want us to do is just kind of give a quick resume, would be the wrong word, but a quick history of your path to AOR and to where you are in life right now. Just remind us a little bit of like how you grew up, how you got into the outdoors, and how you eventually ended up deciding to make a career out of being in the outdoors.
Yeah, quick fast track. So originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I think like many people had that positive first time experience at a camp where I had attended and then also became a counselor. Fast forward through college, I worked out in Glacier National Park as a whitewater rafting guide in the summers when I wasn't training for my sport. At that time, I was a rower on the crew, or if you're familiar with that sport. When that culminated, I finished my degree in natural resources and environment, had intentions of working out west, but actually started off as the director of the University of Michigan's outdoor program. And through that outdoor program, I was there for 11 years, had a chance to build and design a climbing wall, you know, lead international trips, teach wilderness medicine, host the Banff Film Festival, kind of all those kind of outdoor activities on a campus. Also during that time, I became a wilderness medicine instructor, which was something that was very passionate to me as a result of a mountaineering accident that we spoke about, which was pretty transformative in my life of actually being on the receiving end of that patient care instead of the giving end. But then I felt it was really important. And I think also managing, you know, myself and others to try to empower them to be outdoors. I was a volunteer for the board of directors at AOR for my professional development while I was at Michigan. And then during that time, position was created for an executive director. I had also become a student of association management and then ran and achieved the position. So have been in the executive director role after I resigned from Michigan and have been working in this space. So that's kind of the quick snapshot. You know, as far as a career, I didn't actually even recognize you could have an outdoor career. It just was something, again, I just did romanticized as something that was just during the summers, but recognize there are so many people who are working on conservation and legislation and manufacturing and education, all those aspects for that outdoor economy I was talking about. So now I'm really proud to be involved in it, in trying to make especially my little sliver of it, facilitated human power recreation, more accessible, more powerful, and improve the facilitator. So that's kind of the quick story jump of where we've been since you and I've last spoke.
All right. And I seem to recall last time we spoke, you were preparing, and I think we talked afterwards as well. You were preparing for, was it the Mighty Mac swim?
You got a good memory.
Because you're a long distance swimmer also, right?
That's correct.
Or you were, you are, you still, are you still, are you still a long distance swimmer? Is this still part of your life?
You know, I've taken a little bit of a pause, but that's just because I've had a pretty major surgery last year on my leg and I'm recovering, but I think I should get back to the pool. So I'll take that as a healthy reminder for me to get back into swimming. yes, I think right before, it was either the first or second time I swam across the Straits of Mackinac. And I guess in the 9 years, if we're going to keep on using that as our last discussion, which is wonderful, I actually swam around Mackinac Island, which is an 8.2-mile swim. So that was the most recent open water swim. So that was a circumnavigation around an island in Lake Huron. And I did that in 2021. So that was the last time, or maybe 22. I might have to look at the calendar here, Jason, and figure out where that was. But open water swimming has just been a tremendous space for me, I think, in to connect with people, to meet new people here in our local community, and of course with the Great Lakes and lakes that we have. It's pretty cool to meet up with all different shapes and sizes and ability levels and laugh, put our wetsuits on and off we go and come back and have a coffee. It's just been a pretty incredible sport.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the swimming, because it's very easy for people to get involved in hiking and a lot of outdoor activities that are super common. But I think there's definitely plenty of people that participate in these, but I think it's less common for people to be swimming, especially somewhere like the cold waters of Michigan, for very long distances. So what was the draw there, and kind of how did you discover, oh yeah, not only do I like to swim, I want to swim in cold water for 8 miles?
No, the way you say it does make me sound kind of crazy. So I'll give you that. So yes, it is something when people ask that question, you know, it's unlike a marathon or something like that, because when you get tired running, you just start walking. And when you get tired swimming,
you can drown.
Okay, I'll let you say it. So, you know, I think I came across it. I mentioned injuries or surgeries, and as a longtime athlete, I think that's just, I've had a lot of them, and swimming seemed like the next best thing for me. And I just got involved with the local community, and again, was swimming laps at a master's program, and someone said, hey, you know, do you want to come out to the lake on a Saturday? And everyone was just so nice. You know, when you meet a group of people and you are in a novice mindset, you can try anything, right? You're willing to give it a go. And I just recognized that getting in that water and that first, you know, you push off and you're watching the fish go by. And yes, there are the weeds that you know, I am convinced that there's sharks in those fresh waters sometimes when you feel something touch your foot and you get a little edgy. But it's just it's exciting to watch the bubbles go by your hand. And obviously with my personality, with my rowing background, I'm a pretty talented grind athlete. So meaning I can do the same monotonous movement over and over and over. I just really enjoy it. I'm not probably selling the sport to you. I can see from your face, but.
I mean, one of the things about this show is we constantly talk to people about things that are difficult. And most of my personal outdoor experiences I most value are the ones that have been the most physically miserable. So I don't think you have to worry about selling people on the aspect that something might be physically demanding or hard and therefore worthwhile.
I think the great thing with open water swimming, and I've talked about this, I think on the last time we spoke, it really is a testament to doing something you didn't think you could do. And by taking a big goal and breaking it down, because when you do these swims, you know, they do often have buoys out or there's a point and you can't see the end destination. Like you can't see 8 miles in front of you. All you can do is get to the next buoy or get to the next point or get to the next boat. It's such a beautiful way of tackling life or things of just like, can I get to the next thing? I get to the next thing. Can I do one more? Can I do one more? And it's just it's a beautiful gift of how you can take something audacious and make it palatable. And I think it's, you know, again, be it parenting or work or wherever you are in life. It's just, I love that that sport gives me that reminder every time.
Yeah. Once you get out at that sort of distance and there's kind of water, at least for an extremely long distance away from you, or maybe even to a certain degree, water in all directions and mostly all you can see with little pinpoints of land, that's got to be a very different environment than when you're walking on flat land. Tell us a little bit about that, like what it's like to suddenly place yourself in this environment where you can stop and realize, oh, I'm very far away from land. It's just me in this water, in this environment that is not a natural environment for a human necessarily to exist in for an extremely long period of time.
You're exactly right. Well, you know, and I know we're going to talk about it in just a little bit, but in the book, The Outdoor mm-hmm. Leader, I do talk about this in one of the chapters about decision-making relative to open water swimming. And I actually talk about swimming across the Straits of Mackinac the second time that I did it. And really in that space, when you leave, we left the Lower Peninsula, you can see the bottom of the water, you know, for just a little bit until the channel drops off. And then you know you're in deeper water, you know, water where big freighters can go through. And there really are just a handful of abutments that you can swim towards. And you're taking an angle and you're swimming across and you realize how small you are. You have got mm-hmm. your wetsuit on. You're trying to stay within a certain range. There are boats around you, but let's be candid, they can't really see you at the end of the day. For someone who's worked on the water, has been a lifeguard, it's really hard to see someone in the water, even with an orange buoy that's tagged behind you. So you have to kind of really think about what decision am I willing to put or risk both myself and those who might have to rescue me. And I talk about that in the book of like the swim isn't just about me. It's recognizing if I don't feel safe or comfortable or if I'm going to become a liability, it's not just me being a liability. I would be putting other people at risk, right? To be like, she didn't train well. She made the bad decision. You know, she didn't follow the safety protocol. Now I'm taking resources and people, you know, away from someone else who probably truly needed it. And is that being selfish? Is that, you know, and your mind does kind of get to a spot when you get tired of, oh, if I just stop swimming, am I just going to float away? You know, am I going to float to Canada at this point? Or, you know, how does that all work? So it's not a panic, but it's controlling your mind and just recognizing how small you truly are. It can be devastating to swim and pull your head up and see that you haven't made progress because of a current or because of, you know, an eddy line or something like that. It's kind of demoralizing and you have to kind of really get into yourself and say, I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. So I love that tension without it being a fool's errand and floating away or not making it. I think I just maybe come back to perspective. It reminds me how small I am, what impact I can have outsized my mind or impact on other people, just how fragile it all is. It's really just humbling. I think at the end of the day, I'd say it's humbling.
It's interesting because you've mentioned multiple times about it making you feel small. So much of our life is about like trying to feed our egos and make us feel larger and more important than we are, right? But there's this weird value to recognizing that you're a tiny infinitesimal creature within this gigantic cosmos. And maybe we wouldn't think that that would be a valuable thing to recognize, but it does really kind of center you. Like when you've mentioned it multiple times, like what is the value that you see in those moments where you recognize how small you are in the grand scheme of things?
That's a really thoughtful question, Jason. I think about, we get so caught up in ourselves, right? We're such selfish individuals and we think all about ourselves even when we try not to be that person. Like, oh, the impact of this decision, or why didn't I get this, or this person did this thing to me. And you just realize in those spaces when you're small, that perspective I keep on coming back to, really what is it all about? You know, where can I make impact? And the sun's going to come out and the moon's going to come out at night if I make this decision or not, or it doesn't center on me. There's greater factors at play. And I think that's just a really grounding thing for us to maybe separate ourselves from ego or accomplishment and achievement and just say, am I where I want to be? Am I the person I want to be? Am I impacting the people who I love around me in the most positive way? And if not, now's a great time to get started on that. Because at the end of the day, that's really all that matters, right? That's really the thing that I can control. But we need to feel small, I think, to see that because I think we live lives that are telling us that we need to be bigger, or we feel the need to project that we're bigger than we actually are.
There's a weird freedom too, to recognizing that you're not the center of the universe, and therefore the weight of the universe isn't solely your responsibility.
That's beautiful. So I love also. How you said that. I love how you said it. No, that is so on point. That is so on point. When we get so caught up in fear or scarcity mindset, you know, I think that's kind of what you're saying. Like, really, it's not about that, right? At the end of the day, it's not about that.
Yeah, there's more than just us in the world. And, you know, we can help each other out.
100%. Yeah.
I know that you also are a parent. To hit back on our 9 years of children growing, does that mean you're now the parent of grown adults or older teenagers? Or
we're getting there. Yeah. Yeah. I'm, you know, Gretel is, she just has finished her first year of college and is now plugging along here and in town, actually at the University of Michigan, and is a athlete actually on the rowing team. So she's finding success in academics and sports and in friendships. And then Thor is my freshman in high school, and he is plugging along both academically and with his instrument, the euphonium, and then he is a goalie for the lacrosse team. So the kids are thriving.
So euphonium is a word I have heard. It is an instrument I have heard of. I could not tell you what it looks like or sounds like or what it is. I'm not going to make you try to emulate the sound of the euphonium, but tell us about that instrument. It's not like you just said he plays the French horn.
Correct. I specifically said the euphonium to honor Thor, but euphonium, it is not a small tuba. But if you looked at it, you would think that's a small tuba. So the euphonium is a low brass instrument, makes it sound like a trombone or in that genre. But he's a accomplished euphonium player, really loves it, brings him great joy. And it's just fun to watch him light up with music.
So you've raised these and continue to be raising these two children who are more or less adults or nearly adults at this point. But you also, you know, are in outdoor education and recreation, and that's a large part of your life. And you mentioned that, you know, one is playing lacrosse. I already forgot what you said.
She's rowing. Yep. Rowers as well.
Rowing. Yeah. Yes. So along that path, tell us a little bit about like your strategies as a parent to kind of introduce those outdoor parts of your life to them as they were growing up, and what that looked like and how they took to it. And yeah, so just tell us a little bit about like trying to make sure the outdoors and nature and an active lifestyle were part of your children's life.
Well, you know, again, I think having the privilege of running an outdoor program when you're raising kids, you know, they got to come on a lot of staff training trips and kind of got to experience it right out of the gate. Going to camp was a really important part of my growing up. You know, that's how I got started in this space and part of our family. And both the kids actually had a chance to go to that same YMCA camp and, you know, develop those friendships and, you know, jump off the docks and learn how to canoe and all those adventures. And I can't recall, Jason, if we had gone to Alaska the last time we spoke. And I don't know if that rings a bell at all. So I'd have to kind of look at the calendar. But we drove from Michigan to Alaska with the kids. So one of the biggest things that my husband, Justin, and I did and prioritized was a pretty epic adventure with the kids when they were smaller. I believe Gretel was in middle school and Thor was maybe ending up elementary. But we prioritized, we budgeted, we saved for it. We had a van. We didn't convert anything or make it fancy, but we lived out of a van and we drove across the UP and then up through Canada. And then all the roads you could drive in Alaska up above the Arctic Circle, and we camped. And it was just one of the most incredible experiences I think we could have with our family, to be out there and just to have to work as a small living community, right? Everyone has to contribute, be it getting the water or doing the dishes, setting up the tent. And then, of course, you're in these miraculous places. And so that, I think, was not maybe a common experience, but I think maybe a foundational experience for our family.
I think this definitely occurred afterwards. That's quite a drive. So you could either try to condense that into as little time as possible and then spend all your time in that van, or you could really stretch it out. Was that like over a summer or over a month? Like, what did that look like?
We took 6 weeks. And so we drove up and we have been as a family trying to visit the national park. So that, you know, national parks have been something that my husband and I have always enjoyed. And we've been able to visit a fair bit of them and prioritize our vacations around that. And then this trip was a chance to visit many of them along the way. So we took about a week or so to drive to Alaska. And then we were in Alaska for about a month and then another week to come back. So my husband, Justin, and I drove there one time before after college in a small Saturn along the Alaskan Highway, which was, that was not for the faint of heart at that time. It seems like the highway is a little better maintained. But really, you know, the experience, and we were just talking about this the other night about how foundational that was for our family to have that time with the kids to do something that was a little bit out of pocket than most. And I know it sounds outlandish. I own that. You and I have talked about place-based recreation, and here I am saying we drove to Alaska, but it just...
But we also were saying how valuable it is to do both. So yeah. this totally tracks.
But just the priority, right? I mean, there's never enough time. There's never enough money. There's always travel sports and band camps and all of those things. And just to take that pause and to say, this is really important for our relationships and for us, can we do this? And there were tears, mine and the kids, and there was trials and tribulations and there was excitement and there was mishaps, you know, along the way, but that was the whole adventure. I mean, just the magic of it all. One of the things that we've experienced on every adventure with our kids, that it takes about 24 hours for them to let go of technology and creature comforts. And I want to be really clear. We make it very comfortable for them. I mean, each kid had like a bench seat in a 12-passenger van. So there was not lack of moment or movement or that sort of thing. But I think it takes them a while to get into that headspace of, you know, at the end of the night, we're going to walk around camp, or we're going to read a book, or we're going to play cards, or we're going to sit by the fire. And there's an uncomfortableness until they embrace it. And I think that embracing is what Justin and I love so much, to see the kids wander off, or to have them make little boats out of leaves and send them down the river, or to watch Thor drop stones into something, or maybe Gretel's journaling. I mean, that's kind of where you just sit back and look and marvel at the kids and how magnificent they are. They're just wonderful people. And you're talking about things around that dinner table because you're all making dinner together, right? You're all cleaning up together. And it just is, it's so simple. It's beautiful. I mean, it almost makes me emotional to think about how magical that time was. And that's, I haven't even mentioned the mountains or the bears or the rivers, right? It's just,
right. Just
that time with them to see their awareness, to learn the stories that we're being told as we travel across and think about the exploitation of people and lands, right? We read all the placards as a family. We talk about those times and those people that came before us. And we talk about our impact on what we're having on the people who will come behind us too. And I think those are robust conversations to have with your kids at any point.
I think your 24-hour to separate point is not even just children. It's true for adults also. Maybe for adults, it takes longer than 24 hours to break their brain away from work and email and text messages and all the various different responsibilities and bills and all those responsibilities that are easy to just always be floating around in your head, distracting you from everything else. Yeah, I could see where this could be a super valuable experience for so many reasons. One, just the separation from just normal everyday life and experiencing this new type of life. But then also driving to Alaska, that's got to be ground that's not as frequently tread.
Yes.
People drive around the U.S., people drive through Canada, but cutting across the West Coast up to Alaska, not as common, probably relatively unique in comparison to the other environments you could have driven through or taken them through. So did you cut across the northern U.S. or did you, since you started in Michigan, did you go straight into Canada and continue from there? What was the path? You know,
Justin does just a great job in itinerary planning. So we had a page by page checklist of things and he really does wonderful with that, with allowing time and space for the kids and for me to adjust, right? You can't always go, 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 or else you have lots more tiers. So we went up to the UP, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and there's a Highway 2 that basically goes west. So we took that out, you know, through the Badlands and through North Dakota and in all that area up into Glacier, kind of in that space. And I used to work in Glacier. We didn't stop along that way, but then went up to Canmore and Banff. And we've got some friends who are up there. So we spent some time in that space, actually celebrated Canada's, I'm drawing a blank now, on the day of celebration of in July with the Mounties and parades and whatnot. And then went up through the Jasper and the Icefield Parkway, which is just beyond. It's incredible to see Athabasca Glacier and whatnot. And then I think we had to do west from there out to the Cazier Highway, if I'm saying it correctly, and then traveled up British Columbia. And that was probably one of the more remote places that we've been. We drove up kind of the spine there of the Canadian British Columbia up into the Yukon Territory. You know, you're visiting Jack London's home, your Dawson Creek, if I'm getting those correct. We got into Alaska. We took a plane into Glacier Bay, got to see glaciers calving from the Cessna, you know, got into our car again and then went up through, the Northwest Territory up to like Chicken, Alaska. There's a road that is, I think it's called
Top of the World or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, Top of the World Highway. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So driving that, you know, and seeing elk herds go by and then got into Alaska. And then once you get into Alaska, there's essentially kind of a triangle that you can drive from Tok to Anchorage, Anchorage up to Fairbanks and Fairbanks back to Tok. And so we did that with side trips down to the Kenai Fjords and other places, Homer and Wrangell St. Elias. We were in there up to the Arctic Circle from Fairbanks. I actually flew out to go to the Outdoor Retailer Show because I was needed to go through that. And so Justin and the kids spent a couple days in Denali while I was out of pocket and then flew back in. And then we did the whole drive down the Alaska Highway, which is kind of that tip to tail. You know, then you end up through Liard Hot Springs and coming out through Saskatchewan and all the way across back to Michigan. So it was there and back again, as the hobbits would say.
Hopefully there was no scourging of the Shire when you returned. Yeah, that sounds like an absolutely fantastic experience to have. So you mentioned earlier about, you know, taking 24 hours for the kids to kind of break away from their usual lifestyle, get used to this new lifestyle. But now a number of years have passed since that. Where does this trip kind of sit in everyone's mind at this point? Like, when people reflect in your family that reflect back on this, kind of what are those conversations that everyone has?
Yeah, Gretel, my oldest, she always talks about how she, I think, loathed that trip. You know, I think she was a seventh grader.
Oh, really?
And she talks about like, can you imagine being in a van with your parents for 6 weeks, you know? And so she always bemoans it. And of course, everyone, when they hear about it as an adult, we're like, what an experience, right? But mm-hmm. Depends what eyes you see it through. I think both kids probably really did like and enjoy it. But again, time will tell, and we'll probably see in their memoirs if that was an impactful experience or not. You know, Thor is kind of a can-do, and he'll just kind of come along. I mean, I think about him. I think he forgot his hat and gloves. So we had other trials on that trip, you know, having to do something as simple as that, you know, not bringing the right gear and making sure he was warm because he was kind of a smaller kid. But, you know, they're both up for the adventures. I mean, it has led for, you know, we have other opportunities that present themselves and we just say, hey, we'd like to go on this experience. Would you like to come? And they know what they're getting themselves into. You know, again, Gretel just always prefers, she would like maybe the hotel and concierge and room service would be her liking. But I do actually think that she's probably enjoying the outdoors more as she ages. It might have just been the attitude of a middle schooler at that time.
I can't imagine that they both didn't gain such valuable, just a number of valuable things that maybe they don't even yet appreciate until later in life from that experience.
I think so. Yeah, you know, and we do, you know, I think you're right. I mean, a family, like when we travel, you're like, does everyone drink water? Does everyone have their rain gear? But, you know, you don't have to ask the kids because they know how to take care of themselves. They know how to... Right. Plan, you know, I think Thor often travels with the first aid kit and he just, you know, each of them probably has a sense of self-responsibility, but also a sense of how they impact others. And I think that's really, again, that gift of living in kind of a tighter quarters or having that experience. But I think, yeah, I'm sure it's something that will probably has that impact. And I don't know which way it was, being with your sibling or watching mom and dad be relaxed or just the awe and wonder. I probably should ask him those questions.
The ultimate reward for you one day that may occur is if you become a grandmother and they have their own children, if the day comes when they say, hey, we're taking the kids on a trip up to Alaska in a vehicle for a long period of time, and you'll know, yes,
we did it.
I had the impact that I wanted.
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, no, that's something to think about, right? Right. You know, we project the things that are important to us onto our kids, and I think they have to either take them up or maybe they go a different direction. So who knows? Right. Maybe both kids will end up in urban environments, or maybe they'll, you know, tuck aside that need to rejuvenate with outdoor experiences. So, yeah, we like to have those adventures, and hopefully they will as well, and we'll keep on inviting them, and then we'll let them choose if they want to join us or not, and that will be their prerogative.
So I think now is a great time for us to transition into your book, which is all about being a leader and an outdoor leader, right? Which is, we have verified, is something you have been doing for more than 14 years. 14 years with AOR, and then even before. So obviously you have experience with it. Tell us about that path to recognizing, hey, I've been doing all these different things that involve being a leader and helping other people become leaders. Maybe I should write a book. What was the path that got you to this seems like a good time to write a book.
Well, isn't it always a good time to write a book? You know, I think that lots of us think about that. So
that's right.
Yeah. You know, again, we've talked about how crucial or critical the pandemic has been in so many people's lives. And really what happened to me in this instance is that Mountaineers Books, who publish out of Seattle, approached me and they came to me and asked me if I would consider writing a book. So I had a really unique opportunity and an invitation to share this message about leadership and being an outdoor leader that they granted to me. So this book was inspired by a book that came before called Outdoor Leadership, written by John Graham. And so revisiting some of those topics and components 20 years from the first iteration. But where this changes is really, again, the gift of this leadership journey is there for everyone. So it's not a how-to book. It's kind of a how-you book. It's about your leadership journey told through my stories and experiences in the outdoor space. But the chapters are all about decision-making, leadership as choice, conflict resolution. And I just think that the outdoor environment just hits those points home in such a poignant way. That's really the offer of the book is having any person, if you've spent a lot of time outdoors or no time outdoors, hopefully you will see yourself and be empowered by the stories and by the take-home messages in each chapter.
So when you were approached about the book, did you immediately say, oh, this is a great idea, I should write this book? Or were you very reluctant and had to convince yourself to write the book? What was that journey and maybe that roller coaster ride? Because that's a big responsibility to take on.
It is. I think when it first came up, my first thought was like, who can I connect you with who could write this book for you? And I actually, right. that's what I was thinking. I, you know, in my role as the ED, I'm very fortunate to touch base with lots of people industry-wide, lots of great leaders and people that you know of that we read about. And so I was thinking like, oh, I'd love to open the door for these other individuals, not thinking that my offer would resonate maybe with readers, or maybe actually a lot of imposter syndrome of saying, how could the messages I have be important for others to read? And you and I were laughing before we jumped on the podcast about the irony of writing a book on leadership and then talking about this when leadership is all about, I think, other people and helping empower other people. So it's a little bit of an uncomfortable space. It's a lot of an uncomfortable space for me. At the end of the day, my cheeks are probably getting more and more red as we're talking about this. So it felt like a privilege, I think, is what it felt like. It felt like privilege to be asked, and it felt like a privilege to be able to carry this and think that what I can offer can be of value to other people and in service of other people.
I think when someone else asks you to write a book, that might be the best path to writing a book, because then you know at least one group of people wants your book.
Someone's going to read it.
And that they recognize you as an expert in whatever they're asking you to write a book about. So that's got to be helpful when someone comes to you and says, hey, we think you know what you're talking about. You should write a book about this for people. That's much better than someone, I hope at least one person wants this book and no one's asking for it. It's much better than that. So writing a book is a huge undertaking. So what did that look like? How long a time period did it take? Are you used to this style of writing and having an editor come in and help you improve your writing or modify your writing? Was that all new to you, or were you used to a lot of this process?
You know, the only edits I've ever gotten back have been on papers for school, you know, and being that way, or, you know, maybe an article
here. Face at the top.
Exactly.
You did a great job. Great essay.
Yeah, that or you misspelled this and I can't read that,
right.
Which is more likely with my handwriting. But, you know, it really was a tremendous experience. I believe the process took about a year and a half, if I recall correctly. And some things were pushed back because of supply chain and deadlines, you know, as we were all navigating that space. But really, the first order of business was to think about the chapters. And again, I recognized the book that came before, and that was kind of the jumping off point of saying, you know, what are some core things that are relevant or not relevant? Like, for example, in the original book, there was a book on women in leadership. Well, we don't necessarily need to have a chapter on that anymore.
Right,
we
right.
can infuse that throughout. But I think that's, again, part of the reason that I was selected was as a woman, as someone who works in the outdoor space and as a leader and holds a position in a leadership role, you know, it kind of brings all of those things together. So the process was thinking of the topics and then what are the takeaways, right? So for each chapter, it ends with a transferable or thirsty for more. So things for a reader can reflect and think about how they can apply that in their own life. And once I had those components framed out, I was able to think about stories of my mishaps. And really, Jason, this book is really all about learning. And I think leadership is all about learning, making a decision, seeing what the outcome is. If you like the outcome, trying to repeat that decision in the future. If you didn't like it, how would I need to change course? And so really it's all of these highs and lows and in-betweens of 20 plus years of working in the outdoor, you know, in response to injuries and accidents, goal setting, weather, co-leaders I didn't get along with, times where, you know, I had been overly selfish or braggadocious in how something went awry, and then to articulate that point. So I wrote down thoughts. I spoke to people. I dictated. I would turn iterations in, and then they would edit them and actually make it sound readable. So I very much, you know, as an expressive individual, it was really nice to have them help me try to hone in on the point, right? To take all of this vision and passion that I have as a person and say, these are the four or five takeaways from this chapter and go from there.
So when you were approached, the expectations you had of what this process would be like versus what the reality was, how closely did those jive with each other?
Way different. Yeah. You know, you don't even know, right? When you hear about writing a book, either someone being asked to, or I'm going to write their next novel, you don't really think about how that happens. Or I didn't ever think about how that happens. Right. So you start setting deadlines and how many pages and word counts. And, you know, you seem like you have all the time in the world and you don't have an idea. And then of course, a week out, you're like, I have all the ideas. I don't have enough time. And, you know, just running yourself through the ringer of how that works. And I'd say another part of it is just that vulnerability, right? These are all my stories, how I experience them. And there's time that happened. And you know, this as a storyteller, right? So how I might remember our conversation 9 years ago, we probably have some things spot on, and there might be things that are embellished and some things that we missed. And so I think there was a little bit of an awareness that I ran into of like, my co-leader may not have experienced this the same way, or most definitely they didn't, but this is what I took away at that moment. And so I'm hoping to have done justice to those things. And again, just like with leadership, I'm sure I've made some mistakes and, you know, honoring that. And it really is all about that journey though, that process for me. And you're probably hearing that theme over and over again, be it swimming, be it parenting, be it writing a book, is I want to do something, stating I'm going to do it, try my best, and then see how it turns out. And then if I like it, keep on going. If I don't, I'll change course.
So what do you think that you got from writing the book? Because obviously you're trying to share what is hopefully going to be seen as very valuable information for other people. But during that process, you're going to go on your own internal journey and begin at one point and end probably a very different person than how you began. So what was that process like for you? What did you take from the process overall?
Oh, this is getting deep and I love it. So
that's what I'm here for. That's what I'm here for.
It's good. You know, I think there's just so much self-doubt is what was part of the process, and also so much confidence. So I think I liked how that held the tension both ways, right? Like, man, am I enough? Do I have enough to say, or am I sharing and saying the right things? Back to, gosh, I missed so many pieces. We've talked about inclusivity a lot on this podcast today. It's an area that I have been late to the party. You know, I didn't even see these things because I was continuing to perpetuate, just as I probably do today, some of these things that I benefit from. And so here I am being chosen to write a book about outdoor leadership and then having a chapter on diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Just how off-brand or on-brand is that? You know, where am I in that journey and how can I improve that? And recognizing how many missteps I've made in that space time and time again, and just feeling like, ah, man, I wish I could have started over. I wish I started from a different space, right? And then the other end of it is that confidence of, I have some great experiences to share. And if I can uplift someone or help them feel empowered or get outdoors or set an audacious goal, like taking their family on an adventure or choosing a sport or being more active, then that's a gift. And I've done that. I have value in that space, even if it isn't always having achieved something, just the journey itself, that grit and grind. And I think I had maybe honored that in myself and my personality to this point. I think I've undervalued that. Imposter syndrome or not wanting to draw attention to that for fear, for insecurity. So I think those are some thoughts I have on that process.
So metaphorically, it was like swimming across Mackinac. Metaphorically, yeah. You had done it before physically, and now you get to do it mentally and emotionally through the elongated process of writing a book.
Right? That was really good. Tying that in, because there were those buoys, those deadlines and those chapters, and then getting that feedback like, I need to train a little bit more here, or this just isn't working so well. There's a lot of chafing here, right? There's a lot of chafing in the wetsuit. There's a lot of chafing in the writing. So have to ease that one out.
Yeah, as much as it's a little goofy for me to make that comparison, there actually probably a lot of the grit and determination and things that you learned from doing long distance swims, from doing things outdoors, probably really did help in the process of writing the book and then prepare you psychologically in a way that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You know, I think that's a great way to think about that preparation and what is the end goal and what does that look like? And also a chance, I think this book really does talk about redefining leadership, right? And especially in outdoors, we've glorified certain leaders who maybe should or shouldn't have been glorified in adventures, right? Epic quest or so-and-so did this the fastest or was the highest or the first, but at what cost? And we've also not held accountable people who have done some bad decision-making that have resulted in tragedy or death or, again, coming into a space where they maybe really weren't welcomed. And I think this book was kind of a process to unveil leadership as anyone can lead, right? You're a leader, I'm a leader, my kids are leaders, and every day we get to choose to lead. It just depends where you want to show up on that leadership. It's not something that only one person gets to be. So I think at the end of the day, the book is about that journey and leadership as choice. Those would be kind of the big takeaways for the book.
So let's talk about who the book is for specifically. And then remind us again what the title of the book is.
The book is for anyone who is a leader. It really is a leadership book, and the messages come through the outdoors. So anyone who has a connective to wild spaces or places, that is the stories that will hit those points home. And the title of the book is called The Outdoor Leader. So we just try to make it real simple, just real transparent there.
Right. What is this book about? Well, we already told you.
That's right. That's so going back to those essays, right? Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So
that's right. That's right. I just heard somebody saying that exact same thing recently about essay writing is exactly that. Remind me, has the book released already? Or is by the time this episode comes out, it definitely will have been released. Right. It is out now, right? When did it release?
March 1st it came out. So March 1st. It was published by The Mountaineers. And it's available at Mountaineers and my new website called Leading Valiantly, which is something actually also that has happened since we last spoke. Other places like Amazon are spots where people can find the book.
Okay. So at the time of this recording, it's been about a little over two months since it came out. So what has the feedback been like for you?
Yeah, the feedback has been really wonderful. You know, I think it was really neat is that my community has just been so supportive. And I also should mention there's also 20 contributing authors to the book. So again, I had a chance to work with great leaders. And so there's a lot of little anecdotes that kind of complement the story. So it's not just my iteration of things, but someone
sharing
it.
That seems like a very wise decision to do that. Yeah, to include, to the value of like a spectrum of ideas there. I think that's very wise to do that. Yeah.
It was neat. People from all different sectors and different places that they've led and people that they've led. And so one of the cool things that happened is that as people were getting their copies, they've been taking pictures and kind of sharing, like, I just got a copy of this thing. And then I had this big pause of like, well, what happens when people start reading it? The cover looks great, but you know, what happens when they open it up? But you know, I've heard some great feedback from people just sharing, just real readable, real, they can hear the tone of my voice, really conversational. You know, it's not a heavy lift. The sections are little vignettes, you know, so it's really palatable. And I think it is giving people both pause and confidence and empowerment all at the same time. I think for the business sector people that have been sharing with me, they just like the approach, again, decision-making, visioning, strategic thinking and how it's just relayed through, again, the analogy of an outdoor experience, but they can see that and applying that in their work. So I think the reception has been pretty well, and I'm excited about that.
The day the book was going to release, I imagine two things going on there. intense anxiety. Did I write a good book? Are people going to like this book? But then the excitement, because this is your first book. Am I correct about that?
That's correct. Yeah.
Right. So this is the first time you get to see all these words you've written put together in this paper with someone's art on the cover, and it's going to be out there. Anyone who wants it can acquire it. So there's going to be like an intense excitement and probably an intense anxiety simultaneously. Is that the case?
You totally got it right. So you hit it. I mean, it's one thing to have this project, right? And you're chipping away at it. And, you know, the team at Mountaineers have just been so supportive, but you just don't really think about it. This is their business, right? So I just feel like honored that I get to get on a phone call with them and talk about, hey, did you see the graphics or this or that? And you don't really see the end product in mind. You know, you're working on it so long. And all of a sudden, you know, this box shows up and there's my first shipment. And, you know, we had it stacked on our coffee table, and you see your name along the spine of the book, you know, and you're just like, holy, you know, like, I didn't say the word, but, you know, that's my name on a book. You know, it was really overwhelming, right, to see that. You know, one of the neat things, again, with the spine, there's a little compass next to that. And really, the book talks about finding your true north and finding where you are in your leadership journey. And so that was just a beautiful to see that, you know, to feel that. And then again, I definitely am going through those feelings of like, oh, what are people going to think when they read those stories or know a little bit more about me, kind of the deeper dive? Like, well, some people who I've known for years find out something new. But again, that's the ego talking. It's not about me. It's about this gift of this leadership journey and trying to empower someone else. So it's nerve-wracking, and it's also awesome at the same time. So it's wild. Again, friends and family have been so supportive, you know, trying to encourage me to do a book release thing or, you know, some public speaking and just all those things that come along with it. I just couldn't ask for a more supportive group of friends and family nationwide trying to elevate the words that are in this book.
Interesting thing about your book, too, it could be very many years before you're aware if it's had an impact or what impact it has had. A lot of people write a book, maybe it's fictionalized account of something, or it's their retelling of a non-fictional event, and they're going to get that immediate feedback because it's about what people think about what they just read. But so much of what your book is going to be about is things people can integrate into their own life, and it may take them a while to see the results of that. So this could be a situation where 15, 20 years from now, you're wondering, did this book leave any sort of impact? And you start finding out, oh, it did. All these people are telling me, oh, this is because I read this book, or, oh, thank you for this book. So my hope for you is that as your life continues far down the line, you'll keep finding out that this book has impacted people along the way. That's what I hope for you. What is your hope for this book and what it gives to people?
That was so thoughtful of you to say, Jason. I'm feeling like we should look at nine years from now for our next conversation. So
That's right. We'll put it on the books right now.
So gosh, that was just so thoughtful of you to say that. And I do think, you know, before I answer your question, there have been past student employees and people I've volunteered with or led with who have reached out, you know, and said, I just want to tell you, like, you know, the impact you've had on me, right? That's just always, I think we forget to tell people, and I definitely have made it a point in my life to reach back to teachers and coaches and say, I want to thank you. I can see the gift that you gave me so many more years down the road. So gosh, so to answer the question for me, what impact I think that it would have, I think I've used the word empowering lots of times in this conversation, but I want people to think about what they can do, you know, and whatever the thing is that they want, that challenge that is facing them, that they can do it. And I want them to know that that I'm here to support them, you know, literally as both a friend or as someone in that book of saying, you can make things that you can't even realize come to life. And I say that because we're midway through today. I've had a chance to go to the gym and work out with a great group of people. And I think having a community of people who help elevate you is just such a gift, right? So I think I want this book to be that invitation for an individual to do something that they've always wanted to do and to get it done, or to allow themselves to have the dream and then put a plan of action to achieve it, no matter where it is. Is it getting outdoors? Is it, you know, going on an adventure? Is it asking for a promotion? Is it writing a book? Is it taking something on? And this book is a invitation and giving someone permission to do that. That's what I want people to think about.
And so when you finished this book, were you thankful that Mountaineer's book came to you and asked you to write this book? Did you feel like you became a better, stronger, a more experienced person because of the process of writing this book?
I think so, Jason. I mean, as a highly expressive, emotional, passionate person, it just gave me a chance actually to revisit people and relationships and thank them. You know, I think it gave me a chance to go through the stories, to call people who I haven't connected with in a long time, to go through that process with mountaineers. And even some of the people on their team said, hey, you know, I read this section and I decided to do something differently. Like, your book has already had an impact. And I mean, that was kind of like, wow, it makes me emotional just to think that this editor shared that with me, to think like, this is a good thing. This is a good offer. And there's value in that. And it's not in the achievement of the things, right? And I think that's that difference here. It's not, you know, my stories in here are, I'm not the strongest, the fastest, the fittest. I haven't climbed the highest mountains. I haven't rafted the strongest rivers, but I still put a life jacket on when I go on the water, and I know how to pack a backpack and hike down the trail, and I know how to take care of people around me. Anyone can do that. Anyone can be a leader. They just need to make that choice. And I think that's the lasting impact I think I want to have.
Now that you're a published author, should we expect future works from you?
Well, the running joke right now, tying it back to the kids, is maybe a parenting book. So there's lots of parenting things happening, I think, when your kids go off to school or whatever's next, or high school. And so we've been trying to think about some funny titles, What's Wrong With Your Face, or I Told You So, or You Should Have Listened to Me. You know, I think those are some titles we're kind of working, kind of brainstorming with that. So yeah, the outdoor parents. So we'll see.
All right. So before we even started this call, we talked about how we're both terrible at marketing. You accepted the challenge of writing this book, which is a terrifying, scary thing to do, and you overcame it and you succeeded at that. So now I'm going to ask you to do another terrifying, scary thing, which is tell people why they should buy your book.
Oh, you like set the T-ball on the tee. So
that's
so,
right.
Yeah. I would like people to buy the book to find a relatable leadership guide, a place where anyone can lead. And this book will be your handbook, your guidebook. It's not going to let you fail because you can't once you start down this journey. So you should buy this book if you're looking for inspiration, relatability, some comedy, some mishaps, you know, like, and it's all in there. And there's a fair bit of vulnerability throughout the book, where I've gone wrong, mistakes I've made. And so I invite you to come learn with me. Come grow with me.
All right. And so before we get to the very final question of this, is there anything else about this book that we should know that we have not covered yet?
There's awesome graphics in here that are put together, like that are relatable. And again, there's that reflective piece at the end of the book. So I think at the end of a chapter, someone can really just say, what is she trying to say here? And how can I apply this to my life? So again, it's Brené Brown meets the outdoors, right? It's a TED Talk in the form of a book with little chapters. And so if you are nervous about reading a book, this is not a hard read. Right. But it's a reflective read.
And so now we will get to that very final question, which I cannot imagine you remember at all. I'm not even positive if I asked it.
I'm nervous right now.
It was so early in the podcast when I first talked to you. I don't even know if I had this question yet. So the final question that I always ask everyone is based on everything we've talked about today. What is the final thought you want to leave the audience with?
Leadership is choice, and good leaders make better choices repeatedly. That's all it is. It's super simple.
And so with that, we have completed this podcast. So thank you for sitting down with me wherever you are so you could talk to me in the garage, which we timed, thankfully, just before the construction across the street has gone into full effect. So thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Great to see you. I'll see you in 2033, right? 2033.
Yeah, 33, 9 more years. It's that part of the show where I invite you all to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 125 with Johnette Stosky, and there you will find photographs of her in action and links to everything we talked about in today's show.
And if you're ever unsure about how to get to our website or to get to any of the links discussed in the episode, take a look in the show notes. However you are listening to this episode, you should be able to access show notes, which have links to everything we talked about. It will also link to things like the Go Get Outside Instagram page, where you can follow along with our new adventures here in Spain, or the various YouTube videos that I have been releasing under Go Get Outside on YouTube. And if you would like to get in touch with us here at the show, there are a number of ways to do that. You can always send me an email, jason@gogetoutside.com, or you can leave a text message or leave a voicemail. And because I am now overseas, I feel obligated to include the plus one in this number, but you can reach us at +1 818-925-0106. And as always, I implore you to do me a great favor and go to your podcast purveyor of choice. Make sure you are subscribed, rate and review the show if you would, but most importantly, please share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. Next time on the show, come back September 1st for a conversation with Christopher Robert Abbey. He is a filmmaker, motion graphics artist, art director, backpacker, canyoneer, road tripper, and an ex-Disney World furry. September 1st, Christopher Robert Abbey. See you then.